Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, a new show for and about people who think big. I'm Vas Christodoulou, the Academy's Deputy Director and the producer of this series, bringing you conversation and debate from the world's most insightful thinkers. For 20 years, the author and activist Michael Pollan has been writing about the places where the human and natural worlds intersect, including, most famously, in his acclaimed books on the ethics and ecology of food. That path recently led him to investigate the role of mind-altering drugs in human culture, a journey that climaxed in Michael volunteering himself as a guinea pig for several therapeutically guided LSD trips. In this week's episode, presenter Matthew Stadlin and I take a trip of the more familiar kind, visiting Michael in his hotel room to find out more about the new science of psychedelics.
Michael, I don't imagine you've reached a totally settled view yet on psychedelics, but could we begin at the end of at least the journey in the book? Can you give us in synopsis form what you do think of psychedelics?
I think psychedelics are very useful tools for several things. I think they have potentially great promise as a therapeutic agent to help us deal with various forms of mental illness and distress, from depression and anxiety to addiction, possibly eating disorders and other forms of stuck thinking.
And anxiety about death, for example, and if you've got cancer and you're a terminal patient.
Particularly anxiety about death. Some of the most moving work that's been done in the research to date has been giving psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, to people with cancer diagnoses. And it had remarkable success lifting the siege of their anxiety and fear. That's quite remarkable. We have very little to offer people in that situation. I think they also may prove to be valuable tools in understanding consciousness, which science to date has a lot of trouble getting anywhere with. But one way to understand any complex system is to disturb it. And that's certainly what psychedelics do to normal waking consciousness. And lastly, I think they have value as a tool for people who are not ill in any diagnosable way, as a means of personal growth, spiritual exploration. And, you know, anyone interested in really exploring the landscape of their own minds.
You find yourself using hackneyed phrases in the book, phrases that are cliche, and yet they kind of come real for you. You point to yourself and say, can't quite believe I'm saying this, I'm going on this spiritual journey or whatever. But you had some rather positive outcomes.
I did. To cite one example of what you're talking about, one of the classic epiphanies that people have on LSD or psilocybin is the importance of love, and that love is the most important principle in the universe. Now, this sounds like the kind of sentiment you could put on a Hallmark card. On the other hand, it's also true. So how do you navigate that as a writer? Clichés often have a kernel of truth. We protect ourselves against that through our sense of irony, but that's kind of, you know, that's our ego, I think, defending ourselves against strong emotion and sheer repetition, obviously. So it's one of the challenges writing about psychedelics is navigating the very fine edge between banality and profundity.
What perhaps I should have said at the outset is I'm hugely skeptical about psychedelics and about illegal drugs in general. Mm-hmm. And I realize there's a big contradiction in the way I lead my life as someone who drinks alcohol. But we'll leave that to one side for a moment. But I just wanted to be fair and give the context. it's quite a claim to say that potentially psychedelics could have real therapeutic use.
Yeah.
But it's an important word, potentially. And you yourself are not a scientist. You've gone on this journey and you've done a hell of a lot of research. You've looked into the history of it. You've talked to all sorts of people and you've actually taken some of these drugs yourself. But a lot does hang on that word, potentially.
Sure. Well, we're in the middle of a process. These drugs are being trialed as therapeutic agents in England by the team at Imperial College, led by Robin Carhart-Harris and David Nutt. And in the U.S. at places like NYU and Johns Hopkins at University of California, San Francisco. And they've conducted pilot studies and phase two studies. But the real test to prove the promise of a new drug, new psychiatric drug, is trialing it on hundreds of people at multiple sites. And that's happening now. And it isn't until we have the results of those trials that we can say with any certainty that we've got a good treatment here for depression or addiction. The signs are good. The small trials have had very powerful results, far in excess of other psychiatric medicines we've tried, far in excess of the kinds of gains the SSRI antidepressants had when they were introduced. But it's still all promise until we get to that point and the EMA or the FDA says, yes, these are drugs that actually work better than placebo and should be introduced into the pharmacopoeia. So my saying that they have great potential is based on the science that's been published so far. I mean, these are peer-reviewed studies. This isn't just speculation.
Nonetheless, I'd be curious as to whether you felt a responsibility writing the book, because to some degree, this is a defense of and almost a championing of psychedelics, and you're a hugely and widely respected figure. So what you say will have impact. And my worry would be that people who perhaps might be particularly vulnerable to using psychedelics, of which there are presumably many, might read your work and be tempted to do things that they shouldn't. Now, I'm going to be coming across here as very puritanical, but I do mean it.
Yeah, I worry about that too. I mean, I think it's a completely legitimate worry. If you talk about the positive potential of psychedelics, there are going to be certain people, many people are in desperate straits, who will go ahead and try them. And I'm sure many have. And that's one of the reasons that, I take pains to talk about the risks. And also emphasize that the way they're being used in this therapeutic context is very different than the way they are used recreationally. And it's really important to underscore that we're talking about guided psychedelic journeys. It isn't just a drug, it's a package. And an equally important part of that package is heavy therapeutic support. So in the kinds of experiences I'm describing in the book that are going on at the universities, but also are going on underground, and those are the experiences I have, you're working with a guide or two. They prepare you very carefully before the experience, what to expect, how to deal with any difficulties that come up, because people do have terrifying experiences. People, really get in touch with their shadow self, and that can be very difficult if you're alone. If a therapist prepares you properly, that's all manageable. And by prepare, I mean they basically help you understand the importance of surrendering to what's happening in your head. So if they'll tell you, if you feel like you're dying, going crazy, melting, go with it. Don't fight it. It's when you fight that dissolution of self or ego, which often happens on a high-dose psychedelic trip, that's when you'll get anxious. But if you go with it, it can be quite ecstatic and therapeutic. So you have that kind of preparation. Then they sit with you during the whole experience. You're never left alone. They keep an eye on your body. They make sure you don't get up and do anything stupid. They offer a comforting hand if you're getting upset, help you get up and go to the bathroom or whatever it is. And then after the experience, you sit down with them and debrief and have what's called an integration session where you really make sense of what can be an extremely confusing experience and apply the lessons to the conduct of your own life. So that's not, casual at all. And to the extent I'm saying, hey, this could have value, I'm saying that's it, not simply taking the drug under any context. So I do feel very responsible, and I always discuss risks when I talk about it. And the risks, which are not very serious physiologically. In other words, the drugs are, there's no lethal dose of either LSD or psilocybin, which is quite remarkable given how many legal drugs have a lethal dose and it's not that high. They're non-addictive too. They're not drugs of abuse in that sense. However, there are psychological risks. There are people who shouldn't take it. And one of the reasons to take it with a guide is that person will check you out and make sure that you're sturdy enough and make sure you're not at risk for schizophrenia or any kind of psychosis, because people in that situation should stay away.
Although, of course, this is a guide who hasn't got the medical qualifications that a doctor would have. So you say they check them out.
Yeah.
And I'd be hesitant to use words such as thorough or controlled, precisely because these people are
well, you're talking about,
outside
well,
the
we
system.
Should make the distinction. Yeah, they're underground guides. And these are, that's who I worked with, because I couldn't get into any of the university trials. Obviously, the first choice, if you were seeking this kind of therapy, would be to sign up, volunteer for one of the trials. And there are, you know, there's a waiting list for people who want to get in. There's a depression trial right here in London that's recruiting right now at Imperial College. There are trials for MDMA and for trauma that MAPS is doing in both Europe and the United States. So you can dig around and find these trials. I worked underground with guides. They were professional therapists. Although they were not MDs, they had me fill out a medical questionnaire that was read by an MD, and he's looking for, or she's looking for any kind of worrisome signs that would disqualify me.
And you didn't take ecstasy because of your heart?
Yeah. So I asked my own doctor. I asked my cardiologist before I embarked on this. And, you know, the difference between in taking psychedelics when you're 60 as opposed to 20 is you have a cardiologist that you might want to consult. And he warned me off of one of the substances I was considering. That was MDMA. And the reason was that I had a something called atrial fibrillation. I've since had it fixed. But MDMA is a kind of amphetamine, so it raises heart rate. So he thought you should stay away from that one.
Could you describe briefly what it was actually like taking LSD? What happened to you?
Well, first, I would say that it's not so different between LSD and psilocybin. The main difference is, obviously, dose makes a big difference in both cases, but the main difference is the length of the experience. LSD lasts a long time. What many people say about LSD is it's fantastic, and then it goes on for six more hours. and that's a problem in the therapeutic context because, you know, the therapists want to get home for dinner too, and it's a long day.
But is a bar to potentially use as therapy.
It's very time intensive for the therapist, but for a short amount of time. You're not going back to the therapist every week for a year. You're using a couple days of the therapist's time in a very concentrated way, because you're not going to take these, if these drugs are approved, you won't take them every day. You won't take them every week. You'll take them once or twice in your life, probably. And that's what's kind of remarkable about them. It's a transformative experience.
That in itself might not be a very good business model, of course.
It's a challenging business model. I don't know how the pharmaceutical companies get their head around a drug that not only is public domain out of patent, but you're going to sell one or two pills to each patient. And how much can you charge for that pill? So I think that, yes, there are definite business model challenges. My experience with LSD, which I was very nervous about because I had read all the scare stories. I mean, I was a very reluctant psychonaut. But it was a very interesting, very autobiographical experience. I spent many of those hours lying on my back, listening to music, thinking about the people in my life and the feelings I had for them and the things I had failed to say to them. And spent a lot of time thinking about my son and my parents and my wife.
Your difficult grandmother.
Yes, my difficult grandmother. And it was just it was this kind of like review, and they were very present to me. I could especially the ones who had passed, like my grandmother, they were very present. And in general, it was very positive feelings. I didn't get in touch with any, like, you know, latent anger or anything. It was all love. And that's where I got to that point of how am I going to describe this brilliant insight I've had about love without sounding like a total idiot? I mean, they're great literary challenges to dealing with psychedelics on the page. So it was not a high dose experience. I wasn't challenged in the way I became challenged on some of the other drugs. And that was partly a result, for various reasons. I was a little nervous about taking a big dose and did not. But I found it, it's a very clean drug. You don't have any stomach upset. You don't have any, you just really feel it's working on your head, and that's about it.
And talk to us about the experiences you had the night before you would take drugs, because you describe the anxiety, and you describe that, in your view, as the ego.
So before I went on any of these journeys, I had a sleepless night of anxiety in the warm-up. And there were two voices in my head. One of them was saying, are you crazy? You're 60 years old. You're going to go up on this mountain way off the grid with this guy. And you barely know. You've met him once.
Literally a mountain, we should say.
Literally a mountain. Oh, yeah. This was the middle of nowhere. And he was off the grid. I think all he had was a satellite modem or something. And if something happens, what if you do have a heart attack? Is he going to call 911 and summon help at risk to his own safety? And then another voice would say, but aren't you curious? Don't you want to see what you're going to learn about your mind? And you've got a book to write, by the way, buddy. And it would ping pong back and forth. And much to my relief, the voice that said, just do it, prevailed. And I came eventually to recognize that other voice with making all the rational arguments as my ego. Our ego is this voice in our heads that protects us, defends us, and but disconnects us too. And I realized the ego doesn't like the whole idea of psychedelics. The ego is threatened by psychedelics because, indeed, psychedelics directly challenge the sovereignty of the ego.
I would say that psychedelics, and not having tried them myself and having sort of, as I intimated earlier, an inbuilt skepticism about the whole thing, I would say that they take us out of our humanity, that they're fiddling with our agency. You describe it as ego, but I kind of think I've got a problem with that. Tell me why you think I shouldn't.
I won't tell you why you shouldn't. If that's how you feel, you should stay away from them. I'm not an evangelist. I'm not trying to tell anybody what to think. I would only ask that you examine this distinction between the chemicals your own brain produces and the moods that result therefrom and the illusions or perceptions. I mean, all mental activity is chemically mediated and electrically mediated. And why is that superior to taking an exogenous chemical, something produced by a mushroom? For many cultures, the fact that nature was providing these chemicals was a sign of incredible sacredness and connection to the natural world. But I also think there's a Puritan idea here that we need to work for our states of enlightenment. And I see that, but I think it's worth questioning. You know, the idea is that if you climb to the top of the mountain and get this extraordinary view, that's superior than the guy who landed on a helicopter. And in some ways, psychedelics are shortcuts to the mountain, but you do get the same view.
Well, it's rather like in nature photography and bird photography, I take photographs of birds. And if the photograph has been staged, if you go to a hide where someone is feeding the little owl, even though it's totally lawful,
it's cheating.
It feels like it's cheating on some level. Yeah. And I wonder whether that then does impact the artistic quality of the photograph. Certainly if someone knows that the photograph has been staged, I think it takes something away from it.
Yeah. This isn't false, though. I mean, these experiencers are not in the molecule. They're in your head. Mm. The molecule is starting a process. The molecule is a very unspecific mental amplifier. A very important distinction between psychedelics and most other psychoactive drugs. You know, the effects that cocaine would have on you or an opiate or even caffeine, it's pretty consistent across people. It's a physiological change that we know how that feels, I think, recognize it. The effects that people have on psychedelics are as variable as people themselves. So if you and I both took the same drug, same dose, same room, sitting right here, right now, we would have substantially different experiences. And they would be the product, not of the psilocybin, but of your mind, your unconscious, your experiences, your history, and so would mine.
There are those, Michael, who would say that there's not much difference between chocolate cake and a psychedelic drug. They're both external influences. Mm-hmm. But of course, you probably wouldn't be writing a book about chocolate cake. I know you've written books about food, which is true. But there is obviously, let's be serious, just because there may be a sliding scale, there is a profound difference between what a chocolate cake can induce in you and what a psychedelic drug can induce.
Yeah, but what they both do is they're things from nature that we take into our bodies that affect us. And food affects mood also in all sorts of ways that we're just beginning to learn about. And they're part of our engagement with the natural world. It's a very curious, I mean, the reason I got into looking at altered states of consciousness is it grew out of my passion for plants and our engagement with plants and what we use them for. And we use them for food, and we use them for beauty, and we use them for fiber, for clothing. And then we use them to change consciousness. The desire to change consciousness is a universal human desire. It's a very curious one. It wouldn't seem to be adaptive, but probably is. So you have caffeine helps us work harder, focus, that kind of thing. It's, you know, helped make the Industrial Revolution possible. It changed us in profound ways.
Well, it helps me stay up in the middle of the night for my national radio shows between 1 and 5 in the morning. Otherwise, I'm not sure I'd still be here.
Well, it's a tool. It's a tool. And we figured out a way to use it. And it's more or less harmless. It obviously has much less risk than a psychedelic or an opiate or those kind of things, but it is also addictive. It takes away your agency. It affects your sleep. It changes you. I mean, your baseline is different because you are presumably, you know, have a dependent relationship with caffeine. Nothing wrong with that.
Don't judge me, Michael. Stop it.
I'm off. I can be righteous right now because I haven't had any caffeine for 6 weeks, only as part of an experiment. And I'm planning to go back on it, but it put me in touch with how different we are on caffeine, and that we don't even see it because it's such a transparent drug. Psychedelics are not transparent.
We don't tend to judge it either because it's lawful.
Well, maybe it's lawful because we've accepted it and we've decided it lubricates the wheels of commerce and capitalism and modern life rather than mucks them up the way some drugs do. So it's very interesting the drugs that we choose to make legal or not. It's very hard to make a rational case for some of these decisions. I mean, alcohol, for example, which I certainly don't want to prohibit, nevertheless does a lot more social and medical harm than psychedelics, for example.
So why do you think psychedelics are illegal?
History. I think history has a lot to do with it. And the history of psychedelics, which is a little different than people think, was a period of, if you want to go far enough back, they were used in ancient cultures, many ancient cultures, as part of religious observance, as part of healing ceremonies, divination, things like that. In the modern context, drugs kind of burst upon the scene beginning really in the 1950s. They were researched heavily. They were not illegal. They were believed to be important psychiatric, you know, wonder drugs in many cases. There were 6 international conferences on LSD in the 50s and early 60s. 1,000 papers were published, 40,000 research subjects. So nobody thought about banning them then. They were just, it was just, let's research this. Here we've got something that could really help people and teach us something about the mind.
And LSD, of course, was only invented or discovered in the middle of the 20th century.
Yeah. It's first synthesized in 1938, but not recognized that there was anything psychoactive until 1943. And then it's kind of released. Sandoz, the pharmaceutical company where it was invented, didn't know what it was good for, and basically offered it to any researcher who for free, as long as they would report back on what they discovered. And this began this worldwide research program that goes through the 50s till Sandoz withdraws it in the early 60s. So it became illegal, though, because it was used recklessly. It was embraced by the counterculture. It escaped the lab, as people say, and had a profound effect on the counterculture that was very challenging.
How would you define recklessly, though?
Well, you know, when psychedelics arrive in our culture, they didn't come with an instruction manual, and they were weird, powerful drugs, and people didn't know quite how to use them. So you had things going on in the 60s where, you know, the acid tests, where they would just put them in a punch bowl, and people were dosed without their permission. That's reckless. It's cruel, actually. But that was considered like, hey, that's a cool thing to do. people took them in really bad environments, you know, on the New York City subway, you know, not a good place to take a psychedelic. And I think it's because people didn't really understand them. And some people had wonderful experiences. And so it was very mixed bag, but it wasn't done with a lot of deliberateness or care. And this led to some bad outcomes. There were people who, no doubt, who committed suicide on psychedelics. There were people who ended up in psych wards who had psychotic breaks. This really happened. People walking into traffic because their judgment was impaired. So there began a backlash that really became a full-scale moral panic about these drugs. President Nixon believed that they were sapping the will of American youth, their willingness to fight in the war. He thought that psychedelics helped fuel the anti-war movement, and he may well have been right. They did have a profound effect on society. They contributed to what we call the generation gap, a real effort on the part of young people to create their own culture apart from adult culture and reject the values of adult culture. So adult culture reacted, fiercely and banned them. And the media turned against them, and they had terrible press beginning in 1965 after having incredibly good press before that. Now we're back in a good press cycle. It could change again.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p with the code HOWTO. Just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
But given the risks of taking these drugs in the wrong circumstances, and if you're the wrong person or you have the wrong mindset, would you endorse them becoming legal again? Because the way in which you took them is very different to the way that they might be taken if they were made legal. And by being made legal, in a sense, they would then be endorsed by the state.
Yeah, and I think that's very different even than decriminalization. You know, I live in California, and we've watched what happened with the legalization of cannabis, which is a mixed bag. The sky has not fallen. However, when big corporations get involved, and as soon as you legalize a drug, that will happen, not only are they made available to people who might want them or have good use for them, but they're pushed on people. And we have very aggressive cannabis marketing now, and cannabis is being put in forms that make it, including your chocolate cake now can be had with cannabis, that make them really serious drugs and serious experiences.
You're trying to tempt me, aren't you?
So, I don't think the time is here for legalizing psilocybin outside of a medical context. I don't believe they should be criminalized. I don't think the individual should go to jail for possessing, growing, or using a mushroom.
Just to spell out to those of us who haven't quite grasped the difference between a drug being made legal and decriminalization.
So decriminalization means it's just a very low priority for law enforcement, and that's made clear, or that there is no penalty, or the penalty is minor. It's a misdemeanor. It's a traffic ticket kind of thing. Versus the state saying, this is legal, we're now going to tax it. Right. Corporations can, either with a license or without, can start selling it to people. They can advertise it. They can come up with clever new delivery systems and do what capitalism does, which is create needs and then feed them.
And decriminalization in a decriminalized world.
You still wouldn't have any kind of sales.
Would dealers still be punished?
I don't know. There'd probably be some sort of up to a certain point. No. But or not, or maybe dealers would be. It would encourage people to grow their own mushrooms, which people can do.
In what time?
Or find them. You know, the mushrooms grow all over the UK.
In the time that remains to us, I want to kind of return us to consciousness and your experience of mind-altered states taking some of these drugs. Was it interesting to you, Michael, given your love of plants and your fascination by plants and the fact that you've written about plants, that under an induced state, I think when you were taking mushrooms, the plants developed different dimensions, that you felt that they were speaking back to you. And also in one case, and I don't know whether this was mushrooms, but you felt like you were in a cage, but the plant was able to go out of the cage, something that you were unable to do.
Both that was in ayahuasca.
And in an induced state. Sorry, that was in...
ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is a plant drug, and people often have planty imagery with it. It's a combination of two plants from the Amazon. And I had, you know, I've always been interested in the human engagement with the plant world, and I'm a passionate gardener. And one of the things that psychedelics did for me was connect me to plants in a way I'd never felt connected before. I'd always had a sense that they had some agency, that they affected us and we didn't just affect them, and that we co-evolved with things like corn and tulips and cannabis, and we changed one another in the process. And I understood that in an intellectual way, but on these couple of these trips, but one in particular I'm thinking of, I understood it on a visceral level, that I had a sense of the plants in my garden being conscious, not the way we're conscious exactly, not self-conscious, but aware of me, returning my gaze. And it was the most uncanny thing. And that, you know, we tend to think we're the only thinking, feeling subject when we walk through nature, and everything else is some mute object.
Some people even think, as you say in the book, of other people as objects.
As objects, yes. And that's the ego. Yeah. That's the ego's thing, that I'm the subject and everything else is an object, and therefore I can use it, exploit it, do what I want with it. And that's very powerful, and it's enabled us to control nature and do a lot of things, and exploit people. But here, you just have this sense that you are, it is more like you than you ever imagined before. And it was quite a beautiful thing. The plants, you know, were very benign. They appreciated what I had done for them, I think. And
how could they be anything other to you?
I did plant them. I gave them this habitat. But I felt more connected to nature than I had ever had before. And that reaction is not uncommon on psychedelics. In fact, it's even been measured. The psychologists who have a scale for everything have a nature connectedness scale. How much do you feel part of nature, or how much do you feel you stand outside of nature? And that changes on psychedelics.
One of the most fascinating passages of the book is where you talk explicitly about consciousness, trying to understand what it really is. And it seems to me a really exciting area of science, something that we probably haven't quite totally got to grips with.
No.
One of the things that you say is that arguably our sense of reality, normal consciousness, the sort of consciousness that you and I are experiencing now, unless you are secretly on one of these psychedelic drugs, and I'm taking it that you're not.
I'm not.
One of the things you say...
I have used no psychedelics since I published the book.
One of the things that you say is that consciousness, our perception of reality on a day-to-day basis, is perhaps just a controlled hallucination. That's a deeply provocative thing. And of course, what it does is it suggests that maybe our everyday experiences are not much different or not superior hierarchically than, say, our dream state.
Yeah, so this is actually kind of a current theory in neuroscience right now. And it goes under the heading predictive coding or predictive processing, that we take in the minimum amount of information from our environment through the senses and then make an educated guess as to what we're seeing. So if we see a certain pattern of green in this kind of fractal design from thick limbs to thinner to leaves, da, 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 we project the image of a tree. And then our senses help us correct it. And so to a remarkable extent, what we experience is a product of our imaginations. It's been informed by experience before. It's based on a lot of history, and it's checked for accuracy. But
it's a sort of neuroefficiency.
It is. It's much easier than having to rebuild the picture from scratch every time. You know, you remember how computers would build an image very slowly? They learn to do this too. We've taught them to do this too, where they infer as much as they take in. And this kind of predictive coding is screwed up by psychedelics, and you get sort of in touch with it, because suddenly you're seeing things that don't exist. Your mind is projecting faces on clouds, for example. Suddenly, you take a chaotic field like that, and we're seeing images. And you get a sense of how that process works. That or the paranoid fantasy, too, is another belief that you're imposing on reality. So one of I think the really exciting things about psychedelics is that, you know, one way to understand a complex system is disorder it in some sense, and then it reveals its secrets the way a particle accelerator does with a particle. So I think there's a lot to be learned about consciousness from this, and that we operate on the basis of priors, prior beliefs, prior perceptions. You bring your beliefs about psychedelics or drugs to the reading of my book, and you read it differently than someone else would. So we're not blank slates by any means. We're very crowded slates. And one of the things psychedelics do is dissolve those beliefs for a period of time. That's why maybe you should consider it.
Just very finally, now that you've shaken the snow globe and you've gone on this journey, has it changed your understanding fundamentally of the world and of yourself?
Yeah, it has in some important ways. I had the most profound experience I had was of a complete ego dissolution on psilocybin in a guided trip where I felt very safe and had a high dose. And I saw what I recognized as myself, my ego, burst into a little cloud of post-it notes and then saw it spread out on the ground like a coat of paint. Yet I beheld this scene from some new perspective that was completely untroubled by it. I don't know what that new perspective was, but I got a distance on my ego or sense of self that I had never had before. And that I think that's been useful. I can kind of recognize it when he's up to his old tricks or getting defensive or reacting in a defensive way. And that perspective, I think, has proven to be really useful in day-to-day life and especially dealing with hard situations. Sometimes I'll sit there and someone will be attacking me about something I've written or something, and I'll think to myself, hey, I don't feel defensive. And that's a very freeing sense.
And will you do more psychedelics?
You know, if they were legal or decriminalized, I would. I think it could be a useful part of my life. I could totally imagine doing them every year on my birthday. Now that I'm so out of the closet about it, I have to be really careful, and I don't want to jeopardize my guides by being in touch with them at this point, just in case anyone's watching.
What does your wife think of this?
My wife, Judith, has undergone an evolution. When I first proposed this and I said I was going to write this book, she had a lot of misgivings because we've been together a very long time, and I was going to have this big experience, potentially life-changing, that she wouldn't be part of. And, you know, all our big experiences have been shared. In the end, she came around. It hadn't occurred to her I might change for the better.
Michael Pollan, it's an absolute pleasure to spend time with you.
Thank you, Matt.
This week's episode of the How To Academy podcast starred Michael Pollan and was presented by Matthew Stadlin. It was produced by me, Vas Christodoulou. Michael's book, How To Change Your Mind, The New Science of Psychedelics, is out now. Subscribe to this podcast and to our YouTube channel for more talks, interviews and debates with thinkers like Steven Pinker, Madeleine Albright and Yuval Noah Harari. And visit us at howtoacademy.com to find out more about who's appearing on our stage this autumn. Thanks for listening.